Not guilty. That was the verdict this week in the case of a 78-year-old Iowan accused of sexually assaulting his late wife. It's a case that has spurred a national discussion. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll start off talking with IPR's own Sarah Bowden about the issues surrounding the Henry Rahons case. Also this hour, Iowa launches a record year of highway projects, the politics of immigration, the possible economic impact of the bird flu outbreak, and ISU researchers test brain activity to detect cybersecurity threats. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the program, the politics of immigration. A symposium is being held today in Iowa City. And a record $700 million this year being spent for construction on state and interstate highway projects. We'll get some details about what exactly that will be spent on from the director of the Department of Transportation. Also, I'll talk with a University of Iowa biostatistician whose work in 2013, yes, 2 years ago, predicted the current spread of avian flu. But first, whatever former state legislator Henry Rahons did with his wife in a nursing home last May 23rd, it was not a crime. That's the verdict. On Wednesday, a jury in northern Iowa found the 78-year-old retired farmer not guilty of sexually assaulting his late wife. Now, prosecutors alleged that Rahons had sex with his wife, Donna, who wasn't capable of consent due to her advanced Alzheimer's disease. The jury took nearly 2 days to deliberate. The not guilty verdict ends this trial. It's attracted national and international attention. It's also raised complicated questions about the nature of consent for cognitively impaired adults. Iowa Public Radio reporter Sarah Bowden has been covering the story for IPR and NPR. She joins me now. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Ben.
First of all, before we get into the details, remind us of the circumstances surrounding what happened in that nursing home in May of 2014.
Henry Rahons said him and his wife didn't have sex. There was some question regarding some video footage of him putting undergarments in a hamper. Prosecutors alleged that he was disposing of evidence. He said he was just picking up his wife's room because he's a good husband. So he denies having sex. Prosecutors and nursing home staff said he had had sex with his wife.
So Henry Rahons and his wife were in a room that was partitioned by a curtain, and there was a roommate there, right, as well.
Right, and she heard noises that to her sounded perhaps sexual. She said it was unclear what she was hearing, but she said they made her uncomfortable, the noises.
Mm-hmm. And it's also important in this case that Henry Rahons was told that his wife was so mentally impaired that she could not consent to sex prior to this?
Yeah, perhaps a week or so prior to, her doctor told Mr. Rahons and his late wife's daughters, his stepdaughters, that Donna Rahons was no longer capable of consenting to sex.
So 2 days it took for the jury to reach its verdict of not guilty of assaulting his late wife. Here's Henry Rahons reacting to the verdict. This is minutes after it was read. Right after coming out of the courtroom, he's surrounded by family.
What was their support like throughout the trial and the stress of what this was like for you?
It was awesome. They were by my side all the time. It was awesome.
What were your thoughts when the verdict was read? What were your immediate thoughts?
The truth finally came out.
Let's go home, Dad.
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, there's obviously a very emotional moment for Henry Rahons being acquitted of this charge of sexually assaulting his late wife. Sarah, talk about the deeper layers to this case, the sort of two prongs of what actually was decided here.
Right. So the jury said that Mr. Rahons was not guilty, though we don't really know why the jury decided that he was not guilty. Now, the first prong could be he simply didn't have sex with her on the night in question. There was some question about DNA evidence, how old seminal fluid stains were on sheets. And then there was also the question of, let's say they did have sex. Was it consensual? Was Mrs. Rahans at a point where she was no longer capable of consenting to sex because of her advanced dementia?
Mm-hmm. And what did we find out in this case about who makes the choice? Who decides if Donna Rahans was able to consent to sex?
Well, prosecutors were saying, argued that once Donna Rahans' doctor said, you know, Donna's no longer capable of consenting to sex, that was the bright line. But that's at the heart of the case. There's a question of whether or not that's appropriate, whether or not a physician can make that sort of call, or whether or not there should be a more kind of formalized legal sort of hearing where there's a judge and multiple witnesses involved.
Mm-hmm. So is there much precedent in this area out there for elder people and sexual rights?
My understanding is that across the U.S. there is a patchwork. In Iowa, it doesn't seem that it's a very formalized process. It also seems like this is a very unique case. So the answer is not really.
Mm-hmm. Are there other opinions from legal experts or nursing homes about the issue of consent?
There's a nursing home in New York where there is a, I think it's called a sexual bill of rights, outlining when and how residents with different degrees of dementia can consent to sex. So, I mean, again, it's a patchwork. And the fact that it was a doctor making this legal decision, a lot of experts say is very problematic. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, there's always a second opinion.
Sure, right. And this idea of consent is a real gray area,
mm-hmm.
Because when you have someone with dementia, they not necessarily perhaps what is language verbally consenting versus what does your body language say, or how do you react to what is, after all, your husband approaching you?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. But also the question is, even if someone says, yes, I want sex, are they at a point mentally where they can no longer fully understand the gravity of that question?
Mm-hmm. And also the question of personhood. We don't want to say this is not a person anymore simply because that person is suffering from dementia. That was part of the discussion, wasn't it?
Yeah. So anthropologist Emily Wenzel from the University of Iowa says that in American culture, memory is linked to personhood. So when you hear people talk about parents or relatives with dementia, they'll say something like, oh, you know, they died last week, but really they died 5 years ago when, you know, they started losing their memory. And she says that's not a fair way or an accurate way to look at human beings.
Mm-hmm. So, Sarah Bowden, finally, what do you think is the takeaway from this case and its verdict?
Well, people who run nursing homes, people who work with dementia patients, attorneys, family members of people with dementia might look at this case and say, what can I do differently? How can we handle this situation differently when it comes to consent? So we don't have to go forward with a criminal trial where I would assume that there's a lot of embarrassment and a lot of hurt feelings associated with what took place this week. So I think that maybe people can work on family counseling, communication. Perhaps there would be a second opinion when it comes to the issue of consent. Also, when the decision is made that perhaps someone no longer is capable of consenting to sex, perhaps more than just one doctor, but a group of people can be a part of that decision.
Okay, Iowa Public Radio reporter Sarah Bowden, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
It's our Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, drivers across Iowa's landscape will soon see benefits of the 10-cent per gallon gasoline tax increase. The Iowa Department of Transportation says it plans to spend a record $700 million this year for construction on state and interstate highway projects. It's a tax increase that took effect on the 1st of March, providing cities and counties with an extra $200 million annually. However, before we get to enjoy the roads and bridge improvements, we'll all need to expect more caution and slow down signs as we traverse the state and run across more highway work zones. Paul Trombino is with us, director of the Iowa Department of Transportation. Paul Trombino, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
$700 million, a record. How much of an increase in construction will this represent?
Overall, in our program over the next 5 years, it's an additional $590 million.
Okay, so this is a huge step up, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a substantial investment in the system. And, you know, again, I can't say enough how appreciative I am for, obviously, the General Assembly and the governor's support. And ultimately, you know, we're going to, I think, make some very good investments to be able to show specifically as to what that return is.
Mm-hmm. The gas tax was put off, debated in the legislature for a long time, over several years. Is all of this road work sort of just, was it sitting on the wish list waiting for this gas tax to finally get crossed, passed?
Well, there's a lot of work that goes into, I would say, delivering all of those projects, not only the projects that we have obviously been able to put in the program and actually get out let into construction this year, but in those next few years too. So there is a quite a bit of shift. There's been a longstanding need, especially on maintenance, you know, what we call stewardship, you know, really extending life of the existing system. And we're going to be able to get at a substantial amount of that over the number of years. And those are the types of projects we can, we'll prepare and get out and get out to bid here in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of the types of construction we'll be seeing, some of the major construction work that will be happening across the state. Just sort of fly over, if you could, so to speak.
Sure. If I was going to fly over from one side to the other side, you're going to start to see the beginnings of Interstate 74 bridge. That's one of the projects that's been planned for a number of years. It was always in the program. It's really beginning in this next coming year. And the reason is that the local work really begins. So we're starting to revise the local connections in preparation for what will be the bridge construction, which will come beginning, I believe, in 18 and 19.
And what communities will that affect in
that
particular?
Quad Cities, yep, Davenport, Bettendorf, mm-hmm. Anywhere along the interstate down there. So it'll be quite a bit of impact. As I go to the other side of the state, I would go into Council Bluffs. That project is going to continue to move along pretty substantially. It's a longstanding project, but we're essentially rebuilding the entire interstate system in and around Council Bluffs. We're really in our beginning phase of that, and a lot of the work is actually getting out of what I would call the ground, so it's more visible, where they're starting to see, you know, overhead ramps and new alignments coming, and there's a lot of work that will happen not only this year, but in the next 4 to 5 years, a substantial amount of work. And then as you progress north there into Sioux City, Interstate 29 has a few more years, essentially, of work to be done before all of that is completed in Sioux City. And it's really in the downtown corridor is really where they're going to be focused. So, you know, those would be three of the ones that would jump off that people will see immediately, you know, probably as we progress into this construction season. And there's a lot more of general maintenance work, bridge work, you know, along various systems that people will see and encounter, whether it's rural state highways or, you know, higher level primary highway that traverse the state. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of work out this year. And what I was always caution people is when you see the work zone signs, you know, slow down, beware, because there's going to be a lot of construction traffic in and around that. And we want to make sure people are safe as they travel through those work zones.
Mm-hmm. Will it be beginning as soon as this summer when people take to the road?
Yes. Oh, yeah. You'll start to see this work. I would say that, you know, I'm going to go on record here that I think winter has left us, and you're going to start to see the work immediately here in the next coming weeks.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we heard about the gas tax, advocates said that many of Iowa's roads and bridges were unsafe for all kinds of vehicles, school buses, ambulances included, and that auto car repair bills would be cut if the tax were approved. Now, you mentioned stewardship, maintenance here.
Mm-hmm.
Of that $700 million, how much is going towards new projects and how much towards the repair and maintenance that was promised with this gas tax?
Of the specific 700, I don't know that answer. I can tell you right now, the vast majority, the bulk of what we do is in what we call stewardship, really maintaining the system, you know, fixing pavements, fixing issues on bridges, dealing with safety issues, you know, trying to deal with some enhancement issues in and around the system where, you know, we have, you know, some bottlenecks or, you know, capacity issues. You know, the vast majority of the dollars overall in the program are in those categories. And further, as we're sort of in the debate right now, working with the Transportation Commission to finalize the next five-year program, which essentially takes us from 2016 through 2025 or 2020. And what we've actually done is added more dollars. We're actually growing further in the future that stewardship category to make sure that we're extending the life of the existing system as long as we can, because that's the most cost-effective way for us to manage the system.
Mm-hmm. Talk a moment about what this money can be used for and what it can't be used for. There's been some controversy in the past few days about that. You can't just hire people to clean the streets in your community.
Sure.
What stipulates what can happen?
Well, as the bill worked it through a process, especially for the new money, which essentially roughly is about $213 million, this will be in 2016. But the way the bill was written is it came in effect essentially the first day of the first month upon enactment by the governor, which as the governor signed it, it made an effect in March, which what that did is it brought additional dollars this fiscal year, in fiscal year 15 that we sit. And so so that's important to understand. Okay, and then the second piece that is a part of the bill is the legislature created an area called legislative intent. And they wanted to be very clear as to what they felt what the money should be done with, what was important about it, and what we've always talked about, and actually been in some of our reports from years ago and even in 2011, where we defined what we called critical road and bridge infrastructure needs. And that's what they wanted to focus on. They wanted to make sure those dollars were really getting into the infrastructure, which is what we always emphasize. The quicker we can get the dollars into the system, the better and lower cost it is, but ultimately the better service and life service you can get out of the system longer term. And so that was always it's written specifically in legislative intent. And so we've had a number of conversations, obviously, with the locals, both counties and cities, to make sure that they really solved that intent. And we made the commitment ourselves, the department, that we will specifically identify all of our projects, and we're asking for cooperation from both cities and counties, because we collect a lot of that reporting, and we will be asking for them to let us know where those additional dollars are being spent and what is the project and what type of projects did they do, and so that we can report that really at the end of this year. And we are going to do the same. And so for us, we're really focused on road and bridge issues. There's a number of pavement issues that we've actually added to the program. We were able to because we knew the dollars were going to come in this fiscal year, and those projects will be let this June. So we added just about $30 million worth of road, pavement, bridge work. We have a safety project that's really needed along the interstate. And so we've done a number of those things, and we believe that the cities and counties will follow along because they have the same needs on their system and will invest those in infrastructure and get those out the door as quick as possible.
Mm-hmm. And finally, before we have to go, say something about the jobs that this will create and the impact on Iowa's economy because of those jobs. This is several hundred million dollars above what we've had in previous years in this year of construction of highways and bridges. Can you quantify that at all?
Yeah, I don't know if I can quantify that specifically, but I think you've already started to see it. I've heard it. The transportation, especially the construction trade area, is really ramping up significantly. And I think the industry has even been talking about that they really need to begin hiring a number of people to really help them move along a lot of the projects that they know are coming, not only at the state level, but at the city and county level. So we expect this to be a substantial investment in the state. We also would expect to see that investment extend into employment across the construction industry. I would strongly expect that. But more so in the end, is like I like to say, is, you know, why transportation matters is because it really aids not only to the quality of life, but it really aids to economic opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I think what we heard strongly from a lot of businesses, and I know the legislature heard the same thing, is that a lot of businesses really feel the infrastructure needs significant improvement for them to be economic competitive in the future. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that is really, I think, the overriding piece, is that we feel confident that we're going to be able to make a number of investments that will improve and keep the economic competitiveness, not of our state, but ultimately of the businesses and all of us that work in those businesses in the state. You know, that's critically important.
More specifically to the construction jobs, that will be repairing the bridges, building new roads, and so forth. Does Iowa have the workforce? We're down to unemployment levels that are pre-recession levels, about 4%. Or will we have to import workers? Will we be pulling workers from other states, perhaps?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I can answer that question, but I will say I know the industry is, we've obviously talked with our contracting industry. They have, I think, a strong plan to continue. You know, like any industry, they want to be an attractive place for people to work. So I expect them to make a strong push for workers in their industry. And it's something they've been working on for a number of years. And this, I think, really accelerates that process. So I expect that there'll be a lot of employment from the state in the construction industry.
Paul Trombino, director of the Iowa Department of Transportation, thank you for these words of what to expect in the coming months and years on our roads and bridges.
Thank you very much for your time.
It's your Friday News Buzz from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. After meeting as individual singer-songwriters in 2001, Deb Talon and Steve Tannen formed the folk-pop duo The Weepies. And over the next decade, they fell in love, started a family, and made four albums, becoming fan favorites and selling over a million albums, with original songs like World Spins Madly On.
I woke up and wished that I was dead, with an aching in my head. I lay motionless in bed. I thought of you and where you'd gone. Let the world spin madly on.
Then in 2011, they took a break from performing to focus on their family. And more recently, they moved here to Iowa to put down roots in Iowa City. And now they've released a new album, Sirens. They're about to embark on a national tour. This afternoon at 2 o'clock, they'll be giving their very first concert since 2011. It will be at the Java House in downtown Iowa City. The performance will be recorded for Iowa Public Radio's Java Blend. That's the other show I host here on IPR. Let's listen to one of the tracks of the new album, an album created while Deb successfully battled breast cancer. This track is called No Trouble.
A couple of my friends are a couple in divorce. They test me on my right and I say, oh yes, of course. Love is not a law anybody can enforce. Anybody can enforce.
No Trouble, from a new album by The Weepies. The husband and wife duo, Steve Tannen and Deb Talon, now Iowans. They'll be giving their first public concert since 2011 this afternoon at 2 at the Java House in downtown Iowa City. It's a performance for IPR's Java Blend that's open to the public. Coming up in the second half hour, the possible economic impact of the bird flu outbreak, and Iowa State University researchers test brain activity to detect cybersecurity threats. It's your Friday News Buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Sometimes trouble needs me, don't need no trouble. But it's plain to see, I don't need no trouble. Sometimes trouble.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Immigration policy, it's a hot topic. It's a hot topic, especially with the next presidential election fast approaching. Remember, the Iowa caucuses are just about 9 months away. Today, a day-long symposium on immigration is taking place in Iowa City. Panels of academics, politicians, political consultants, and community members discussing different aspects of how the politics around the topic of immigration is playing out around the country. Rene Rocha is with us. He's one of the organizers of the Politics of Immigration Symposium taking place at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center today. It's part of the Forkenbrock series on public policy. Rene, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You are Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Tell us a little bit more about the goal of this symposium. Why now is a time when many of these things need to be addressed?
Well, the Public Policy Center is doing a series of symposiums leading up to the 2016 caucuses. And so they've picked a number of themes that they think are especially important nationally and specifically to Iowa. Obviously, Iowa has seen a large increase in the number of Latinos living in the state, and a large part of that is the result of immigration coming in of people from other countries settling into Iowa. That's also affected the debate nationally, and so it's really one of these issues that has a lot of importance to the country as a whole and specifically to Iowa. You know, there's a lot of overlap there, so we chose to do a symposium dedicated to that and get these multiple perspectives from people working with politicians, from people working on the ground in community organizations, and then academics who are looking at this from more of a bird's eye view approach.
So as a professor of political science, give us your view on how you think immigration is going to factor into the 2016 elections. Will this be, and the caucuses, will this be a major issue, you think?
Well, I definitely think that the Republican Party is being really hard-pressed right now because primary voters tend to have such anti-immigrant or restrictionist policy preferences. They're forcing their candidates to move more in that direction. But you know, we've seen in 2008 and 2012 how that's really hurt them nationally. You know, the Latino vote went three-quarters to Barack Obama in 2012, and this is a constituency which is growing in size. And it's also one in which the Republicans, you know, in theory, could make a play for. I mean, they're, you know, Latino voters are not they're economically liberal. They have some, but you know, they actually have a really kind of diverse set of preferences on immigration policy. There are some socially conservative policy preferences within the community, and so Republicans could make a play. But what they're really doing with the tone of the immigration debate, scholarship has shown, is they're really alienating the Latino community, and their other messages, which might be more appealing, are not getting through. And, you know, that's just going to be a problem now. It's a problem into the future, but it's one which is very difficult to solve given the makeup of their voting base in primaries and in the Iowa caucus.
Mm-hmm. Marco Rubio, a Cuban-American or a second-generation Cuban-American, launched his campaign recently. Do you see him linking up with Latinos in Iowa necessarily?
I mean, he's one of those individuals who's made a move in a more conservative direction. He was part of the Gang of Eight trying to forge a comprehensive immigration reform bill, and that he's abandoned that position and is arguing now for, you know, an enforcement-oriented approach before any kind of legalization efforts can be drawn. And given the inherent differences in the immigration experience between Cubans and people coming from Mexico or other Central and South American countries, you know, it's really difficult to see how that message is going to translate. I mean, one of the things we know about Latino voters is that they are much more driven by actual policy positions than by just kind of partisan loyalty or even personality, because a lot of people are socialized into political parties, right? You know, they're Democrats. Maybe their parents were Democrats. They were just from youth brought into this type of political party. They're much more likely to make these kind of emotive attachments to parties and candidates. But since a lot of Latinos are either they come to the United States as adults and therefore they don't have that socialization experience, or maybe they're second-generation Latinos, but their parents lack that socialization experience and they don't socialize their children very strongly into a particular partisan affiliation, they're much more likely to just make decisions based upon actual policy positions. And so if those policy positions don't match up, then, you know, we don't expect to see the Latino community, you know, back those candidates or back that party.
Rene Rocha, you've written, published multiple papers on the effect of Latino representation at a local level, papers titled, for instance, How Support for Latino Candidates Encourages Municipal Reforms. What aspects don't you hear in the news that you've concentrated on in these papers?
You know, one thing that I think we don't really understand, and this is the subject of my talk at the symposium, is the way in which immigration enforcement has changed and the long-term ramifications of that change for politics. It's not, I mean, one thing that, you know, some of the Democratic consultants and the Republican consultants will be talking about is how it's affecting, you know, who Latinos might be voting for. But you look for more, you got to take a step back and think about the way in which it's affecting how Latinos become involved in politics in the first place. And when you think about why people become involved in politics, there are three basic reasons. It's because they have the time and the money and the resources to do it. It's because parties are mobilizing them. And it's because they want to, that they just have a psychological disposition to become involved. And what we know is that, and some of what my work has shown, is that as immigration enforcement has really dramatically increased over the last decade, not just under Republican administrations, but, you know, under the Obama administration too, is that Latinos have become increasingly more alienated towards government. And so they are losing the one resource that they have, though, that kind of a favorable psychological disposition towards government, which is very common amongst immigrant communities who are, you know, they're opting into the American political system, right? So they may, Latinos may have lower levels of education, they may have lower levels of income, they may be less likely to be mobilized, but they have these positive orientations towards government. And this policy, the way immigration policy is getting enforced, is it's eroding it. And that has long-term implications about kind of diminishing the voice of Latinos in American politics and, you know, having effects that go years and decades into the future. And that's something that we're just really now beginning to appreciate and understand.
Okay, Rene Rocha, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, and one of the organizers of the Politics of Immigration Symposium taking place today in Iowa City at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center. Rene Rocha, thank you very much for the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week about some news items we didn't get to otherwise in our talk shows. This week, concerns about bird flu heightened. Avian flu, influenza caused by viruses adapted to birds, has been striking chicken and turkey farms in the West and also here in the Midwest. This past week, we heard in the news, it hit a flock of millions of egg-laying chickens in northeastern Iowa. They will all have to be euthanized. Jake Olson joins us now, associate professor in the Department of Biostatistics at the University of Iowa. Jake Olson worked on a study in 2013 published in the journal Statistics that predicted the current spread of avian flu. Jake Olson, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me.
How did your study, this model, predict the current bird flu crisis?
What we did was built a statistical model that could predict risk areas of disease. We outlined counties in the entire U.S. and found which counties had higher levels of risk of getting avian flu.
Mm-hmm. And so when you look at Iowa, what are the highest risk counties in Iowa?
In Iowa, our map showed that the western side of Iowa, mostly along the Missouri River, which is where migratory birds happen to fly, and our model is based off of migratory bird patterns.
Mm-hmm. So explain a little bit more about your modeling about it. What does it look like in the U.S.?
In the U.S., our model showed that even though Iowa had elevated risks, which were higher than the national average, it showed that just south of Iowa into Missouri and Arkansas is where we were expecting to see the highest risk levels.
Mm-hmm. And has that turned out to be the case?
Not yet. I think it's still moving. I haven't heard reports of it moving down there yet, and hopefully they take precaution when they see that it's happening here, and a lot of more poultry farms in those areas should just take precaution.
Mm-hmm. So what happens here is the wild fowl get into the domestic flocks and spread the disease?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. How can this type of model help going forward to prevent the spread or more outbreaks?
Well, I think that this type of model, we can forecast where the migratory waterfowl are going and how quickly they will get there, just based off of their migratory patterns. And people down the road can then, once they see upstream the things starting to happen, they just take more precaution so that it doesn't affect things further down the road.
Yeah, precautions like just trying to make sure the domestic fowl do not come into contact to get outdoors and come in contact with the wild fowl.
That is correct.
How do you plan to further develop this model for better use in the future?
Well, one thing we'd like to do is to get more accurate predictions potentially at the farm level, whereas the risk predictions that we have are at the county level. And that would take more specific data per farm to be able to do it. But our modeling would be capable of doing it if we can if we have that available data.
Okay, Jake Olson, Associate Professor in the Department of Biostatistics at the University of Iowa. Thanks for joining us and helping us understand more about the bird flu.
Thank you very much.
It's your Friday News Buzz from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about the heightened concern over an outbreak of avian flu in our news, bird flu, talking about it for a few minutes. Nationally, over 7 million chickens, turkeys, and backyard poultry have been identified since December with avian flu. It can kill a bird within 48 hours. The disease has been discovered at more than 50 sites in several states, including Iowa and Minnesota. Dave Swenson is with us, associate scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. Dave Swenson is someone we check in with to find about economic impacts of certain news events. This is certainly one of them. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
What can you tell us about any economic impact from what we're seeing with the avian flu?
Well, in the short run right now, there's not a great economic impact to be realized. It's, of course, going to be important to those operations that find that they have flu in their operations. But region-wide and statewide, there isn't enough economic damage done to really be noticeable. It would be noticeable if it spreads, and if it spreads, then it could have a not just a region-wide effect, but a statewide effect. Now, let's put this into perspective. The poultry industry generates about 4.1% of the GDP that agriculture produces. So it's less than 1/20th of what agriculture produces. It's an important part of the economy, but it's not that large. But there's another issue with this industry that's very important. 97% of the animals, especially these laying hens, are concentrated in just 1% of the farms. So if this disease spreads from large operation to large operation, it can have a devastating impact on the poultry industry relatively rapidly. 85% of Iowa's farmers that have poultry have fewer than 50 animals. So what we have is the potential, if this disease spreads, for lots of farmers to be affected, potentially, but the number of animals impacted not being that large. So we have kind of a duality to this that needs to be attended to. Our industry, it's a great big export industry. We produce eggs that feed into not just your refrigerator and down to your local diner, but also they go out in tanker trucks and they feed into the food processing industry. So if there is a big impact, meaning that we do end up losing quite a few birds and quite a bit of our egg producing capacity, it will have a regional effect on food production, food processing, and then ultimately to the consumers.
So, Dave Swenson, as an economist, what are you watching in this story going forward?
Well, the most important thing is to whether this spreads, and if this does spread, then we are going to have to start thinking about what kind of disruptions, not just in the food supply, the egg supply, but also what type of disruptions we might find localized in the regions where this disease is occurring. If it doesn't spread, we can breathe easy, but right now everybody's under heightened vigilance, and the big worry is that it is going to spread and it is going to affect a larger number of producers.
Dave Swenson, Associate Scientist in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. It's a pleasure as always. Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome.
And finally, to finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, are you a cybersecurity risk to your company? Perhaps a brain scan can answer that question, or will answer that question in the future. Iowa State University researchers are working to better understand internal cybersecurity threats by getting inside the minds of employees who put their company at risk. Their new study was published in the Journal of Management Information Systems. One of the researchers behind this study, Ching Hu, Associate Dean for Graduate Programs and Research in the College of Business at Iowa State University, also the Union Pacific Professor in Information Systems. Professor Ching Hu, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me on.
Define what you mean by a cybersecurity violation. What are you measuring? This is not necessarily malicious intent, or is it?
It is. When we talk about violation, we talk about malicious. People intentionally violating the rules and policies and procedures an organization has set up and has already informed, educated, trained employees to obey.
Mm-hmm. So what would be an example, a few examples of violations that you would...
For example, if you have access to confidential data, either product design or supplier information or highly secret defense projects and so forth, then you are supposed to keep the secret, not to disclose, not to download to your personal computer, not take the information away from your company system. And if you do such things, download some files and share it with people that are not supposed to be shared, then you are clearly in violation of company policy, and you could be prosecuted criminally or punished internally based on whatever procedures.
So you were looking at the question of what type of people are more likely to be risky in terms of cybersecurity. What were your findings? What did you do here?
Yes, exactly. What we're trying to figure out is why employees knowingly or intentionally to violate this rules and procedures that cause major damage to companies in terms of reputation, revenue loss, and other legal problems. So what in the traditional way is we interview people and we try to understand why. But over the last 10 years, I have done many of this kind of research. I interviewed real hackers. I interviewed employees. I interviewed managers. I interviewed students, say why people do such things. Now, the problem with those kind of studies, they obviously giving us very good information, but it is very hard to tell whether people are telling you the truth, because yeah. Very few people will tell you, yeah, I steal something from the company.
And this is where the brain scan comes in.
Exactly. So the brain neuroscience in recent years, especially the brain imaging technology, has become available to people like me, who we are not neuroscientists, we are not medical professionals, but because of the advances of technology, we are able to use the tools that used to belong to the professional medical domain. Then we can use this to peek into individuals' brain while they were being asked questions or showing different scenarios. And we can see what part of the brain is active or to what degree they are active, and therefore infer some of the possibilities of internal workings of an individual.
Unfortunately, we have just a couple minutes left. So to cut to the chase here, you are measuring the question of how much self-control a person has.
Yes, we're measuring how self-control impacts a person's thinking or behavior in terms of cybersecurity. So our finding indicated that people with low self-control tend to use less of their time, and their brain activities tend to be lower when they're faced with scenarios of cybersecurity compared to people with high self-control.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so and so when we spin this out into the future, and this is widespread and serious, security violations for businesses cost tens of millions of dollars to businesses in the U.S. What does this mean for businesses? Perhaps will this a brain scan be part of a an interview process in the future for some businesses?
No, absolutely not. What we have done is we have validated a survey instrument that can be administered very simply in 10, 15 minutes on paper to have a general understanding of each individual's self-control. And so what we're promoting or advocating is that companies should understand their employee, put the right person into the right position. Now, low self-control employees should not be put into as custodians of sensitive digital data. Mm-hmm. However, they might be very productive, good employees in other positions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very quickly, how do you see low self-control or high self-control in a brain scan?
Basically, we already separated the low and versus high self-control individual using this instrument, this survey instrument I just mentioned. And then we look at their brain activities and we do a comparison to see if there are indeed differences. And what we found is that the differences are indeed significantly, statistically significant.
Okay, Ching Hu is Associate Dean for Graduate Programs and Research in the College of Business at Iowa State University. Fascinating work you're doing. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We want to thank you, Iowa Public Radio listeners, who donated during our spring membership campaign. If you haven't heard yet, you helped us raise enough so that we are able to cancel, yes, cancel the summer pledge drive. Thank you so much. You don't need a brain scan. Know that we are grateful for all of your support. Help today from Jason Burns and John Pemble. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Julia Davis helped us out as well. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.
And stay with us. Coming up next, Science Friday.